With me on the show today is MediaSoc President-elect Sophie Littlewood. Joining us is Eduardo Suarez, an award-winning journalist and head of communications at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism here in Oxford. Eduardo recently published a report looking at media subscriptions and will be discussing his research into digital news, sustainable subscription models, and changing reader habits. I'm your host, George Phillips, and you're listening to Insiders, the Oxford University Media Society podcast. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Eduardo. It's really great to have you here.
Great. Happy to be with you.
And you too as well, Sophie. Sophie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Sophie Littlewood. I am the president-elect for Oxford University Media Society. So I'll be taking over as president in the winter term.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And Eduardo, before we get started discussing everything today, would you be able to introduce yourself quickly? And could you perhaps just tell our listeners a little bit about the Reuters Institute and your position there?
Sure. My name is Eduardo Suarez. I'm the head of communications at the Reuters Institute. I've been a journalist for 20 years. I've been working as a foreign correspondent for the Spanish newspaper El Mundo, reporting from London and New York and Brussels. I've covered the 2016 presidential campaign in the US for Univision. I've been a journalist fellow at the Reuters Institute for 6 months in 2019. During that time, I spent my time researching on reader revenue models in newspapers in Britain and Spain. And about the Reuters Institute, it is part of Oxford University. Our mission is to explore the future of journalism through debate, engagement, and research, and that's what we do. We do academic research about journalism and about the news media. We also run a fellowship program for journalists who join us from everywhere in the world, and we also run leadership courses, leadership programs where, you know, editors-in-chiefs and CEOs from news organizations come to Oxford to learn more about how to do their jobs.
And am I right in saying as well that you do a lot of your research focuses on kind of digital transition, and you've partnered with or you're kind of supported by organizations including Google, aren't you, to produce the digital news report each year?
Yes, I mean, we produce, I would say, like probably a couple of reports every month or so. And once a year, we publish the digital news report, which is, you know, the most important piece of research that we do. It covers 40 countries in every continent, and it will be published in mid-June. I think it's June 16th. As you said, it is supported by Google, but it's also supported by dozens of universities and research centers around the world.
So really important work. And the reason which Sophie and I reached out to you in particular was because we read a report which you'd produced, which is looking at kind of sustainable subscription models, and in particular with a comparison between the UK and Spain. So could you perhaps give us a very brief overview of kind of the aims behind this report, and maybe just highlight a couple of key findings?
Sure. It was part of my journalist fellowship. As I said before, the Reuters Institute has this program where, you know, journalists from around the world join the Institute for a few months and they work on a project. The project that I worked on was precisely reader revenue models in newspapers in Europe, and precisely the UK and Spain. Why UK and Spain? I focus on those two countries because those are countries that I know well. I lived in the UK before for 4 years. Actually, I was in the UK when, you know, most of, or at least some newspapers put paywalls in place. The Financial Times in 2007, the Times and the Sun Times in 2010. So I wanted to explore more about, you know, what make those models successful in the UK and which kind of things the newspapers in Spain should do. Because, you know, the thing is that the newspapers in Spain have been really, really slow to set up digital subscriptions. When I started my my project, none of the big legacy news organizations in Spain were running digital subscriptions, at least in a substantial way. There was one exception, and that was El Diario.es. El Diario is a digital-born news organization. It was created by a few journalists in 2012, and it has been really successful. When I brought my project, they had 35,000 members, and they have the same kind of model as The Guardian, an open model, a membership model. But apart from that, I mean, the other newspapers in Spain didn't run digital subscriptions, but they were starting to consider, launching this kind of model. And I thought that it was a very interesting topic because, this is a country, Spain, where things were about to change. And I think there were lessons that some newspapers in Spain could learn from, a project researching more about what's happening in the US and the other way around, because, there are also lessons that newspapers in the UK can learn from some news organizations in Spain. So I basically interviewed, I think it was 26 executives, senior executives from 15 different news organizations. Most is basically the most important ones in both countries. I also spoke to people in Denmark and Sweden and France and Italy about their experiences too. And I guess if I needed to summarize, the findings, I would say a couple of things. The first one is that, there is no model that that is the right answer for everyone. I think every news organization has to find its own model, and the model has to do with its history and its funding and the ownership. So you have to really find and craft your model around what you are and what you do. And you can see that in the UK, for example. Obviously, the model that The Guardian has to do with its history and with its ownership and with the Scott Trust. And it's very different to the model that the Times or the Sunday Times have. That is a very closed model and more transactional and more a subscription model, not a membership model. So that would be the first lesson. And the second, I think, and that's probably useful for both membership and subscription model, is that you need to create a habit, a daily habit or a weekly habit in your audience in order to run a successful reader revenue model. Not everyone is going to subscribe to your newspaper. There are many people who are probably happy just reading a couple of pieces every month that you publish. You really have to focus, if you run a subscription model, you really have to focus on your most loyal readers, your most loyal audience. Those are the ones who are more likely to subscribe, and you have to create daily habits and create products that encourage people to come back. And in that sense, I think we are seeing, some kind of resurrection of editions, not the kind of printed editions that newspapers used to publish, although they are, so some newspapers are still doing that and still selling newspapers in print, but also digital editions in different forms. It could be a daily podcast, and we are seeing many, many daily podcasts in the UK and beyond, but also daily newsletters. And we are seeing those during the coronavirus crisis, pop-up newsletters, informing people on what is on the latest or on the pandemic, and also more bespoke products like Espresso on The Economist and others. So I think that's definitely something that every successful newspaper is doing right now, creating products that encourage people to come back and create that kind of loyalty and habit that produce subscribers, at least on digital.
If we could go right back to the beginning, talking about the differences between UK and Spain, why do you think the media environment is so different? Why did the UK move towards digital subscriptions first? You talked about the loyalty, perhaps. Would you say that British subscribers are perhaps more loyal to the media? You know, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, that's a really great question, Sophie. And I think, I mean, I'm just here speculating. It's difficult to know exactly the reason, but I would say it has something to do. I mean, both countries share some characteristics. I mean, both countries have a global language, for example. The Spanish and English are global languages. And both, newspapers in both countries can feel the temptation to reach to audiences outside their countries. And this is a temptation that obviously a Dutch or a Danish publication is not going to have. So I also thought about that question when I wrote the report, and I guess that at least what I think is that it's probably something to do with the competition that the British newspaper had on the other side of the pond, right? Because, you know, it's obviously very difficult, or it was obviously very difficult for British newspapers to create a global audience. It was not impossible. And actually, you know, there are a couple of examples, or three examples, I would say, The Guardian, The FT, and The Economist, that have actually created a global audience. But I would say The Guardian is the most interesting case, because they have kind of created a global left-wing brand outside the UK, almost from scratch. In the case of the FT and The Economist, they have always had some kind of global audience. But The Guardian is something that was created probably in the last 10, 15 years, and it has to do with the internet, and it has to do with the kind of scoops that they publish, you know, about Snowden, about WikiLeaks, about all the stuff. And I think they did it really, really well. And they also made the most of, you know, the more moderate stand in the U.S. newspapers. You know, papers like the New York Times or the Washington Post have never had such a strong left-wing point of view, and probably that's something that The Guardian made the most of. The same for Australia. I think they have been creating this global left-wing audience and news brand. And that was really something difficult to do, and that they have achieved. And it has been a success in terms of traffic, web traffic, but also in terms of subscriptions. You know, a huge percentage of their subscribers right now come from outside the UK. And also, you know, those subscribers, especially in the US, are wealthier and probably, you know, are you know, more, I mean, they are more profitable for the brand than their British subscribers. So that's really a success story. In the case of the newspapers in Spain, what happened from the beginning, I guess, is that they pursued volume. They pursued traffic outside their borders. They noticed that they had a lot of traffic and unique users from Latin America, and they tried to, you know, to basically create digital products and digital websites where, you know, they took, you know, they published things about those countries instead of focusing in their core market. Obviously, in this case, it was really difficult to create a subscription business. I think, you know, it's much easier to create a subscription business on your, at least at the beginning, on your core market. And, you know, they decided that it was better for them to play the volume game and get, you know, money from digital advertising. And it is important to stress that, you know, the situation right now is not the situation in 2007 or 2008. You know, at that time, digital advertising was more profitable than it is right now. This is the moment where, Facebook and Twitter and in some way Google are all starting. And, you know, most newspapers, at least in Spain and in other countries, thought that that was the way to go, that it was better for them to actually get their money on digital through advertising. That's something that has backfired for many in the news industry, because most of the digital advertising has gone to the platforms, to Facebook and Google mostly. So that's something that is different right now. The other thing that is different is that obviously, you know, the payment systems and also the payment habits of the population are very different right now. We are all used to make payments online. We are all used to subscribing to things like Netflix or Spotify or HBO. So in a sense, it's easier to convince people to pay for news right now than it was, let's say, 10 years ago. So I think that's the reason why, for example, newspapers like El País in Spain or the New York Times tried at the beginning of the century digital subscriptions and paywalls, and they decided to open their newspapers up because, you know, it was not worth it at the time. There was neither the technology nor the will to pay among readers. And I think that the equation has changed in the last few years. And now, I mean, every newspaper in Spain is either starting their own digital subscription model or considering it. And I think we are going to see that change in the next few months. It's something that we have seen in France, in Italy, in Poland, in Finland, in Germany, in many places, and it's coming to Spain too.
And obviously, you highlight the fact that attitudes since, if you look back 10 years, attitudes have really changed, both in terms of how consumers feel and how, people working in editorial feel with regards to subscription-based models. But I wonder how, what were your findings in terms of, I guess, attitudes of newspapers towards kind of finding that balance between volume and quality when we're looking at readers? Because I know, for example, the Financial Times kind of have introduced this quality reads metric where they're not looking at how many page views they're getting, but rather how engaged the readers actually are. Is that something we're seeing across the board?
Yeah, that's a really interesting metric, the one you mentioned. You know, they have this metric at the FT that they call RFV, which is recency, frequency, and volume. Those are the things that they are focused on, and not so much the number of clicks that they have, the number of page views that they have. They really want to check if you are coming back, if you are a really loyal reader and you are coming back. And, you know, they track usage, which is really, really important. It's not just about the number of clicks that you have. It's about the number of people that you have coming back and the number of subscribers that are actually using the product. Because, one of the problems that many newspapers have is that they get the subscriber, but then the subscriber is not using the product. And you know, once they notice that you're not using the product, they know that it's really, really likely that you're going to churn, that you're going to, you know, abandon, cancel your subscription. So that's the reason that many newspapers are really obsessed about usage and about making readers actually, you know, doing things like download the app, subscribe to newsletters, listening to the podcast, all those kinds of things. And yes, there's always a tension. I mean, probably the Financial Times is a very special case, as it is The Economist, because, you know, those are newspapers that get most of the revenue from subscriptions. And that's still a special case. I mean, most newspapers in Spain and I would say in many countries are still getting revenue from many different sources. And, you know, they get revenue from readers, but they also get revenue, a substantial amount of revenue from advertising. And that's a challenge because advertising is pushing you into publishing more and more, you know, stories every day. Sometimes stories about topics that are, you know, topics like gossip or sports and things that are frivolous and that are not very good for subscriptions and for your, you know, for your prestige as a publication, I would say. But at the same time, you are trying to get subscribers, and what subscribers demand from you is actually quality and a very different kind of topic. So there's always a tension, especially in organizations like the big Spanish newspapers, like El Mundo, El País, even El Diario that I mentioned before, between those kind of revenue streams that are pushing you in opposite directions. As I said before, most Spanish newspapers, big Spanish newspapers, were focused on volume, and they were publishing things on their websites that they wouldn't publish on their printed editions, especially things like gossip and things like that. So now that they are trying to set up digital subscriptions and paywalls, they need to change their product also in that kind of way. I mean, they need to focus on different stories and more, you know, quality stories instead of publishing, you know, any kind of, you know, frivolous tabloid-like, you know, news, right? We are starting to see this, I mean, and especially El Mundo and El País that are, you know, both are the main newspapers in Spain and both have started subscription models, El Mundo in October 2019 and El País in May this year, so actually this month. They are both changing the kind of stories that they are publishing. And I think that's a good development for journalism in Spain. I think that's going to produce better quality. I really think so. We are also seeing newspaper digital-born newspapers like El Confidencial launching their own subscriptions. And as I said before, El Diario, another digital-born organization in Spain, has been really, really successful with a more open model, more similar to The Guardian. So I think your digital product obviously reflects your priorities and the kind of revenue sources that you have. And if, you know, if the Spanish newspapers are going that route, that is going to change the kind of pieces and the kind of journalistic genres that they produce.
Fantastic. And, you know, I'd love to pick you up on your point about how content might be changing as attitudes for people paying changes from ad revenue to subscribers. In the UK, we're very familiar with the tabloids, who very much rely on, you know, as you know, clickbait headlines. But if you're needing to subscribe, do you think that this is going to change their content? Is this the point of where, are we going to see the death of the British tabloid, do you think, as we know it?
Well, that's a big claim. I don't know exactly the answer to that. I mean, what we have seen, and that's something that has been published, is that The Sun tried to sell digital subscriptions for a while. And Rupert Murdoch, the owner of The Sun, was really, really adamant about that. He had launched a paywall for The Times and The Sunday Times, and he launched the same kind of paywall for The Sun, and it didn't work. So that kind of tells you something about the kind of business model that the tabloids probably need. I think it's going to be much more difficult for a tabloid to sell digital subscriptions, especially in a country that is so competitive in terms of media use as the UK. We've seen examples of that. I mean, there are tabloids in the Nordic countries, in Norway or Sweden or Finland, that have launched subscription models. It is not easy. I would say, that is something that is really difficult to do because you need, you need quality content. And I'm not saying, obviously, that, tabloids don't produce some really good journalism from time to time. But most of the things that they produce, I guess, is, pieces that are more that produce probably one time sale on a supermarket or big splashes about sometimes corruption stories, sometimes something that is really really sensational or sensationalized, but it's probably difficult to sell subscriptions that way because it's something subscription is a long time sale. It's something that you don't decide on the spot. You don't decide to subscribe to a publication because you just read a really good headline or a really good story about a politician or about someone else. It's a long time sale. It's something that that you decide for months. I mean, one of the interviewees in my report is Esther Alonso, who is the chief marketing officer of El Diario, and she told me that. I mean, they kind of track the decisions of the readers when they subscribe, and those decisions are made over months sometimes, from the first time that person actually click on a subscription, ad or whatever, until they actually buy the subscription to El Diario, it could be months. That's probably true for every publication that I've studied. This is not something that you decide because you saw a headline or you like an article. You approach the publication, you engage with the publication for some time. You kind of like the stuff that they do. You probably subscribe to one of the free newsletters or a couple of free newsletters. You listen to the podcasts that they produce. And at some point you hit the paywall, or at some point you see an ad, or at some point you see a support our work announcement, and you decide to pay. And I think that kind of relationship is probably more difficult for a tabloid. There are also questions about the wealth of the readers, and it's obviously it's usually working class readers who read the tabloids, and that probably has something to do as well, and also education and other factors. But I think it's probably difficult for a tabloid newspaper to sell digital subscriptions. Having said that, I don't think it is necessarily going to be the death of the British tabloid. I think advertising is still a business model. It is difficult to implement for quality newspapers, but it's probably a bit easier to implement for a tabloid newspaper. I mean, if you are publishing stories about Love Island or about, any kind of scandal or any kind of gossip, or celebrity, it is probably easier to attract eyeballs and to attract, digital advertising than it is for a serious newspaper publishing things about, the public health crisis. So, let's see. I think this crisis is going to be really, really tough for every newspaper and every publication. But it's going to be probably tougher for publications that are, very dependent on digital advertising, and also for publications that frankly haven't invested so much on their digital product. We have known for a while that digital was the way to go, but it was really difficult for newspapers to invest on digital because most of their income was still coming from print, from the sales of their printed edition. But obviously during the pandemic, or at least during lockdown, it has been really, really difficult to actually go to a newsagent or to a supermarket and buy a newspaper, a copy of a newspaper. So, you know, all those publications that had been told for a long time to actually invest in the digital product, now they are facing the music. They are facing this reality in which, you know, actually digital is the only thing that can actually save your publication and is probably the only way to actually reach your readers. So that means that obviously, if you depend on your readers for revenue, you're gonna probably fare better during the crisis. If you have invested on your digital product, you are probably gonna do better during this crisis. And if you depend entirely on advertising, it's gonna be tough because it's not just that some advertising are kind of some advertisers are kind of blocking ads on coronavirus coverage. It's also that there's going to be a huge economic crisis, and in every crisis, you know, companies cut advertising. So it's going to be very tough for every publication, I think. And you know, I think some newspapers will come really strong, you know, from the crisis, but we are going to see in really, really difficult times, and probably some publications are going to disappear.
No, I think it'll be really interesting to see what the landscape looks like in 12 months' time, perhaps. But you've raised a couple of really interesting points there, Eduardo, which I'd like to pick you up on. And you've said, obviously, this is going to be a really tricky time for a lot of news organizations. And I mean, I think the fact that we've already lost so many kind of local and hyper-local publications. We have, for example, the closure as well of the Jewish Chronicle. You know, across the board, there have been closures. But at the same time, I think something which people have acknowledged is that there's been this surge in subscribers. You know, people are reading the news perhaps more than they ever have before. So I have two questions for you, really. The first of which is, how do you think media organizations, newspapers are going to go about kind of trying to retain these subscribers? Because I guess, you know, as with kind of hard drives for new subscribers, churn is going to be an issue. And my second question as well is, I think this has been a really interesting time if we're thinking in terms of paywalls. And by that, I mean that in the past, we've seen obviously a lot of different approaches. For example, you know, the Times, Sunday Times going in with quite a hard paywall, but a lot of papers have moved coronavirus content outside of their paywall. Do you think this is indicative of what's going to happen in the future? Will there be more kind of dynamic paywalls to hook readers and kind of get them in as subscribers?
Yeah, they are both excellent questions, George. On the first one, how to retain readers? You're right. I mean, we are seeing a paradox right now. I mean, you know, every news organization that I know is experiencing, you know, huge volumes of traffic, like huge. I mean, more than ever. And I've seen figures from Spain. I've seen figures from the UK. And it's kind of, is more or less the same in every country, at least every country that I know of. At the same time, every news organization is suffering in terms of revenue, especially, as I said before, the advertising revenue is plummeting. I don't know about the UK so much. In the case of Spain, we are seeing that happening, especially on printed editions, but also on digital, because of tourism, for example. Spain is a country that 12% of GDP comes from tourism. You can imagine which kind of tourist season, you know, we are going to have this year. It's going to be super, super tough. And that, you know, that has obviously an impact for advertising in newspapers, in TV, in radio, in every medium. That's obviously one of the reasons why many news organizations in Spain and in other countries are trying to focus on reader revenue and trying to gain subscribers. As you said, I mean, it's not easy to retain subscribers, and I think that's the main concern in the industry. It is not so difficult to acquire subscribers. You put Facebook ads or Google ads or whatever, and you get a lot of subscribers, not a lot, but, you know, a huge, some amount of subscribers. But one of the interviewees on my paper, Chris Duncan from the Times, told me, well, dirty channels produce a lot of churn. And I think what he meant by dirty channels was precisely that. I mean, if you are impacted or reaching out to people who are actually not so much interested on your product, they can join maybe for a couple of months or for 3 months, but then they are going to leave. And also, that also happened for the FT, for example. When Brexit happened, they had this offer. They basically lifted their paywall for everyone right after Brexit, in 2016. And they gained a lot of new subscribers with that kind of strategy. But the problem was that 3 months after that, when these people who got the newspaper for free had to actually pay for it, most of them actually left. And when I talked to the people at the FT, they told me that, that was not so successful as it appeared at the beginning, because they were reaching, to people who were actually not so much interested in the FT. They didn't have the habit, they didn't have the interest in the kind of content that the FT was producing. So it was kind of a mixed bag. And I think that applies for every newspaper. You have to actually hit with your ads and with your strategy. You have to go after people who are actually interested in your content and in your newspaper. You're never going to get long-term subscribers that were not actually using your product first. So that's the way to retain. And, the experience, for example, that El Diario in Spain, El Diario is not one of the super big newspapers, but it's kind of big. Right now, they employ 100 journalists or so. As I said before, they have right now they have like 55,000 members, and during this crisis they did something that was kind of revolutionary in Spain. They I think at the end of March or so, in the middle of the crisis, they published a post. The founding editor, Ignacio Escolar, published a blog post saying to the readers, "Hey guys, this is an emergency for us. This is going to be really painful. This is an existential crisis for El Diario. If you don't help us, we may disappear. So this is what we are going to do," they said. "We are going to lower the salaries of our journalists, so there's no layoffs, at least in the next few months. We're also going to raise the annual fee that our members pay. So people used to pay 60 euros a year, 60 euros a year. They decided to raise it to 80 euros a year. And they also, they also ask for help. They told people to pay even more if they could. They also told people if you are unemployed or you suddenly can't pay your annual fee, just let us know. And it is fine with us. I mean, just let us know, and you can pay a couple of months after or whatever." So after saying all this, they started March with 36,000 members, paying members, and now they have almost 56,000. So this is the way to do it. You ask how to retain your paying members or your subscribers. I think El Diario strategy was great during the crisis, because they basically shared, they were super transparent with the situation. They acknowledged their own weaknesses. They said to their audience, "Look, this is a really existential crisis for us. It's really, really difficult, and we need your help." I think it worked for them. I think it also worked for them because they have a very strong community and they have been working with them for a long time. And it is probably more difficult for other newspapers, especially for big newspapers, with a different ownership too. I mean, newspapers like El País or El Mundo in Spain, it is difficult for them to build that kind of relationship because they are owned by big companies, and it is probably not it is probably more difficult to do that. For those kinds of newspapers, the way to go is probably with a more transactional proposition, you know, giving your users and your audience more kind of products, trying to build habit, trying to them to use your product more. That's the way, you know, every subscription company achieves success. And we have examples from journalism, but also from other different industries. On the second question, and how to create a paywall strategy in this kind of environment during the pandemic. Of course, I mean, many news organizations have lifted their paywalls for a couple of months. Not every decision was the same. I mean, some newspapers decided to leave their paywalls entirely. Other news organizations, like the New York Times, for example, lifted their paywalls in a few stories, but otherwise, paywalls were still in place. My view on this is that, this is going to be with us for years. This is not going to be with us for a couple of months. The pandemic is a real threat to society everywhere. And it is going to be with us for the long term. So lifting your paywall entirely is not the right strategy. If you are a news organization, getting your money from your readers, I don't think is the right strategy. Having said that, I think it's obviously a public service. There's a public service case, to actually free your coronavirus information, and I think you can always have like a page that is free for everyone, with the basics, with the kind of frequently asked questions about the virus piece, these kinds of things. You can actually have that, but otherwise, I don't think it's really, really intelligent in the midterm or in the long term to actually give away all your stuff during the crisis. I think readers have to understand that quality journalism, it's really is something valuable and is something that is produced by real people, real journalists with expertise and with sources. It is difficult to convince people to pay. Not everyone is going to pay. But I think the important thing here is to create loyalty among the people who are more likely to pay. And I think in this regard, the crisis has been fantastic for journalism, or at least it has created opportunities for journalism, because the stakes are really, really high, and people can understand easily why journalism is important in this situation. It is probably easier to explain people how important journalism is in this kind of situation than it is, during a normal election or during normal times. These are not normal times, and we understand why we really need, fact-checking, and we really need quality and expertise about what is happening right now. That's what journalism is for, and I think the best newspapers have proved, how important this is, and this is showing, and that's the reason we are seeing, subscribers growing in publications like The Atlantic, like El País in Spain, like El Diario in Spain, like The Guardian in the UK, like The Economist. Hopefully, this is a wake-up call for society, and people understand why journalism is important for society as a whole.
And I think what really struck me is how you say that we might be in some form of lockdown for a long time. I'm just thinking about that, and how you've also said that it's clear that we need investment in digital content, that reflects the identity and the quality of the journalism online. Do you think that, for example, maybe podcasts and videos that are very popular with young people, are we going to see more of a role of those diversification of products playing into newspapers' identities?
Hopefully, yes, Sophie. I think one of the problems with newspapers, I think, is that, they have been producing one single product for a couple of centuries, the printed edition of the daily newspaper. And it has been difficult, I think, for the people who work at newspapers to actually produce something else. There hasn't been a lot of innovation in a couple of centuries in terms of product. That obviously changed when digital came along. But for a long time, even in digital, I think, the websites of newspapers looked a lot like printed newspapers. And I think it's because old habits die hard, and it's difficult for journalists to actually think outside the box sometimes. I think we are definitely seeing the last few years innovation in terms of product and in terms of other things, and we are going to see more. I mean, you mentioned podcasting before, and obviously that's one of the priorities right now in the industry. We have studied podcasting at the Reuters Institute. We published a very good report by Nick Newman and Nathan Gallo in December, precisely about daily news podcasts and how many newspapers are adopting those daily podcasts to create habit, as I said before, to engage with their audience much more often. I mean, the big success in that regard is The Daily of the New York Times. That kind of recreates the same experience of the of reading the printed edition in the morning, I guess. It's obviously different because it's just about one topic, but, you know, there's probably the same kind of 20 minutes that you would dedicate to read the daily printed edition of the New York Times is probably the same 20 minutes that people use during their commutes and listening to the daily. We are going to see more of that. We are seeing the resurgence of newsletters, as I said before. Many news organizations are launching newsletters and are running newsletters in many forms. Daily newsletters that are more focused on news, but also niche newsletters. There's an example, for example, in the Times with the Crime Club newsletter that they have. It's a newsletter that gives reviews and free ebooks and event tickets. And that is focused on crime fiction fans. That is a very British thing, I guess. But that's a really successful newsletter. They have like a 70% open rate, which is really, really a lot. I mean, people are really committed to that kind of newsletter, and it's a testament on the kind of loyalty that sometimes people feel for that kind of niche. Topics, people are really passionate about crime fiction, and people are really passionate about things like cricket or bullfighting in Spain, if you want, things that probably don't have a huge audience, but the audience that they have is really, really committed. And I think newspapers should focus more on those kinds of niches, because sometimes people, who are committed to these kind of topics would pay for a subscription to that kind of product if it's a very a product that is tailored to the kind of passion that they have. Definitely we are seeing more innovation, editorial innovation, and we should see more, because this is a new world. There are opportunities out there. There are people who are underserved by the news media right now. And the crisis is an opportunity to find those kind of niches and to succeed, especially right now, because our routines, our daily routines have changed, I guess. We don't do the kind of daily commutes that we used to do. There are, you know, probably gaps that we can still fill in people's lives, and you know, newspapers have to think hard about that, and probably come up with solutions. And you know, I hope that they are successful, because I think there's still room for improvement, especially you know, in daily newspapers that are so stuck sometimes to their daily product. I think there are things that they can still do.
Eduardo, I just wanted to pick up on one thing you said just then before we bring things to a close. You mentioned that there are still people who are underserved by the news media, and I think perhaps you meant that in terms of, you know, kind of catering to the interests of different groups. But if we're looking to the future, I think it's quite clear that there's going to be a move towards, or we're already seeing even a move towards, reader revenue models. Do you think news media organizations are going to have to deal with the challenge of information poverty if they're implementing paid models? Do you think that people might be underserved in that they can't afford to pay for a subscription? So there might come a point where they're almost less left with kind of, I guess, second class news and second class information.
Cool. Many things to unpack in that question. of course, yours. I think there's obviously a risk of that in a society where many, you know, quality news sources go behind a paywall. There's a risk that obviously is not just the poorest citizens; it's also the less educated citizens. Sometimes it's not exactly the same group, and there's a risk with those kinds of groups that they don't actually subscribe to a quality newspaper, and they get you know, news that are less quality, or that they are not from the best publications. I would say that, you know, and that's, by the way, that's something that we have addressed at the Reuters Institute, and there is some research about news inequalities in the UK and beyond. That's definitely something that we are interested in. That's something that we have seen, by the way, so far not so much related to paywalls, but related to the kind of news diet that people have. So you know, people with lower income and people with less formal education are usually getting their news from social media, from messaging apps, and you know, their news diets are probably, you know, not so good as the news diets of people that are more educated or have higher income. So that's something that worries us, obviously. But having said that, I would also say that, you know, a new subscription is not so expensive right now. I mean, a subscription to the Financial Times is super expensive. Don't get me wrong. But subscribing to The Guardian, it's not very expensive. And most of the newspapers is like something like 100 euros a month or 100 pounds a month in the digital form, you know. So I don't think it's super, super expensive. And I would also say that also raises the stakes for the public broadcasters and for public service media, in the sense that, you know, a society like the UK, where the BBC is so prevalent, and the BBC is, you know, is probably the best news organization in the UK, and the one covering, it's probably the biggest newsroom or one of the biggest newsrooms, and the one covering the country more profoundly. You know, that makes that any kind of, you know, news inequality problem probably less likely in the UK than in any other country in Europe. And I would be worried, or I would be more worried in countries like Hungary or Poland, when public service media are controlled by authoritarian governments, for example, or places where public service media don't have the resources that the BBC has, in terms of coverage, in terms of, you know, journalists, reporters. So again, I mean, this is obviously a very different news ecosystem. It is not what happened 10 years ago or 15 years ago, where everything was free, every kind of information for most of the newspapers were free to read, including their archives, by the way. We are going to a very different world where, you know, many news organizations will run some kind of paywall, some kind of, you know, reader revenue model. But I would also say that, you know, as you said before, George, those paywalls are not hard paywalls anymore. Most of them are metered paywalls or, you know, freemium models where, you know, you still have access to some of the content. You probably don't have access to the long form pieces, or you don't have access to the opinion pieces, or, you know, or you only have access to 10 pieces a month or to 15 pieces a month, but you still have access. And, you know, figures from news organizations are very clear on that. Most of us only visit, you know, I don't know, a news organization like twice a month or, you know, five times a month. Most of the readers are like that. You know, we, you know, people like you, like Sophie, like me, we are probably not representative of the population. We tend to read a lot of newspapers. We are news junkies, but most of the population are probably fine, you know, to read an article from time to time, once a day or once, you know, once in a while. So I don't think, I'm not convinced that this is gonna, you know, that this is gonna create a world that is much more unequal in terms of information. There's gonna be an impact, no question about that. But I think the impact is gonna be probably smaller. The other question about this is, you know, is the other way around, is the news inequalities in the sense that bigger publication and the most famous publications are probably going to attract more subscribers. And that's something that we are seeing on our research, research from last year's digital news report, that most of the people subscribe just to one publication, and that creates a dynamics that is winner take most. It's probably not winner take all, but it's winner takes most, and that means that in every country there's going to be one national publication that is going to attract more subscribers than the other ones, or at least one or two, you know, and that creates a challenge, especially for local news organizations, and especially for smaller publications. So I guess that underscores the need that every publication focuses on what it does best and focuses on creating, on fostering their own communities, because otherwise, you know, if people just subscribe to one news organization, they're gonna subscribe to the big news organization in the country. We are seeing that in countries like Poland, for example, where, you know, Gazeta Wyborcza has a lot of subscribers and other publications don't have so many subscribers. So, and also in countries like Sweden or other places. So I think that's definitely a dynamic that we are going to see. And that's also concerning, especially from the point of view of newspapers and journalists who are trying to survive on subscriptions everywhere.
That's really interesting. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of thinking points for our listeners based on everything you've just said. I mean, I think I know that Sophie and I could talk about this all day, but I think unfortunately we might need to start wrapping things up now. So we'll link the report, which we've been discussing, in the show notes, Eduardo, so that listeners can have a look at that. And am I right in saying that if people head over to the Reuters website, they'll be able to find all of the reports which we've been discussing?
Yes, of course. Everyone is welcome to visit the Reuters Institute website. You can also subscribe to our weekly newsletter and follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
Well, fantastic. I think on that note, we'd just love to say thank you so much for joining us today, Eduardo. It's been really fascinating hearing your thoughts in these unprecedented times, and we're very grateful for your time, so thank you.
It's been a real pleasure, Sophie and George, and I wish you good luck for the rest of the term.
Thanks very much to Sophie Littlewood and Eduardo Suarez for joining me today. Remember to head over to the Reuters Institute website if you want to find out more about their work. More information about the Media Society is available at oxfordunimediasoc.com, or you can find us on social media. That's all for today, and we'll see you again soon.